If I hurry, I can get on the tail end of his applause and act as though it's mine. I wonder if Beethoven could imagine that his Ode to Joy would be here in this setting. I think it would have baffled him and then thrilled him. You know, God uses people to do mighty things. And Mr. President, he has used you to put together an extraordinary seminary. I know it's God's work, but... Remember when I taught at Wheaton, one of the BSU workers in the Chicago area was thinking of seminaries, and she mentioned Southeastern, and I didn't even know where that was or what it was, and I think that was the case for many years, and those who did know were not quite as thrilled, but we know who you are now, and it's cooking, so we thank you very much for that. I was looking at Sports Illustrated a couple of weeks ago, and they had a feature about roller coasters, great roller coasters in America, and I was reminded of that sign that you saw at the fairs or at the theme parks. The sign would say, if you can't reach this high, you may not ride the ride. Have you ever seen one of those? Or they'll have a little figure cut out of plywood, and if you can't reach as high as that, then you're not ready yet for the ride. When I look at the first chapter, 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians, I think the same thing, the love chapter. I look at that as something of a sign or a height. And if I can't measure up to it, I'm not ready for the ride. And I must say, it's a very difficult chapter to read because I find myself wanting. It is something embarrassing to read because through it, the Lord is saying to me, you're really not ready for effective ministry yet. But if you will read with me and reflect with me, perhaps we can grow to the measure of this standard. And now I will show you the most excellent way. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I am only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have a faith that can move mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. If I give all I possess to the poor and surrender my body to the flames, but have not love, I gain nothing. Love is patient, love is kind. It does not envy, it does not boast, it is not proud, it is not rude, it is not self-seeking, it is not easily angered, it keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Love never fails. But where there are prophecies, they will cease. Where there are tongues, they will be stilled. Where there is knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part, but when perfection comes, the imperfect disappears. When I was a child, I talked like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I put childish ways behind me. Now we see but a poor reflection as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part. Then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. And now these three remain, faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love. Notice that there are things which love is not and things which love is. And I'm just going to track through those very quickly today. Things that love is not. Well, love is not envious. Love does not envy. When I taught at Wheaton, I went to a Ringling Brothers circus in Chicago, and one of my favorite acts involved, there were always Italian families. There were three or four of these. And one fella stood in front of a sort of a teeter-totter. Someone else was on the low end of it, and someone was on a platform. And the one on the platform jumped on the raised end of the teeter-totter, flipped this guy, and he landed on the shoulders of the guy standing on the ground. And I thought that was pretty impressive. They put another one on the low end. Boom, zoop-da-boop-da-boop, three high now. They stacked them five high. It was incredible how they even hit the mark and then stabilized as they hit. And they're staggering around like this, and it occurred to me that if the third guy up wanted to be on top, he could. All he had to do was go just like this, and he's on top. And the Bible tells us that is not the way of love. Because if you are always saying, boy, I wish I were on top and I think I can do something to make that happen, then chances are you will succeed and chances are you will show that you are not one who loves. Love does not boast, is not boastful. I think God is amused at our boasting. It is so empty. I used to pick this lady up on the way to church in the morning. She was a 90-year-old who had walked to church about a mile named Dixie Maggard. And Dixie and I would usually meet up about the fire station, and she was an incredible inspiration to me. But one day, I asked her how she was doing, and she said, well, Tom Landry called me last night. Oh, wow, it's pretty impressive here in El Dorado, Arkansas, the coach of the Dallas Cowboys calling you. And I said, well, tell me about it. What did he say? Well, she said, he called me and he was talking about this youth ranch for disadvantaged kids in Texas, maybe drug rehab ranch or something like this. And we talked a while, and then he said, well, I want you to stay on the line and my friend will give you the details. Well, it was a recording. You know, it was an automatic dial sort of thing, and Tom Landry had this spiel, and then the guy to take the pledge came on, and he was the living talker. But she thought she'd been chatting it up with Tom, and she was so proud that they were bonding, and I don't know how the conversation went, and I didn't have the heart to tell her. I just kind of squinted and hid my face, and I think when we brag, that's really the way God is. He just says, look, I gave that person his wits, his health, his opportunities, et cetera, and now he's boasting and thinks that he's done it. And when you're so full of yourself that way, you really don't have time to think about other people. And that's not the way of love. Love is not proud. It's in the ballpark with boasting. Love is not proud. I was a brand new teacher at Wheaton College, teaching philosophy back before most of you were born, I think. And I was assigned a teaching assistant. He was a senior in philosophy and a pretty sharp guy. He took one of my classes in his senior year, one of my electives. I think it was a seminar in Kant. And we were 6 weeks, 7 weeks into the semester, and he came into my office and kind of kicked back. He was my grader, and he said, you know, my favorite philosophy teacher is Dave Tomashiro. Well, I wasn't Dave Tomashiro. Dave was another man in the department, and thank you very much, Brad. And my impulse was to say, you know, my favorite philosophy student is Donna Summerfield. And not you, Brad. Now, he told the truth, but he didn't have to say that. That just wounded me. There was a kind of rudeness there in that. And I just think that love is not rude. We have to be very careful not to trample on each other's feelings, and it's so easy to do. And when you're self-absorbed, you forget this, and it just hurts folks when they do that. Well, love is not self-seeking. Love seeketh not its own. Have you ever been a prop at a party where someone is looking for something better? They're talking to you. They don't want to be alone out there in the floor. But they're looking around you. Yeah, fine, sure, yeah, I'm trying to improve on you, but I'll just kind of keep the conversation going until I can work up to something better. And so you're a placeholder while they're on the make. Have you ever been that way? Well, you can bet that that person who is treating you as a prop, as a placeholder while they're working up the chain, is not thinking of you in love. And I don't mean that you have to stay with the same person the entire party. I mean, goodness, that would be quite a thing. But you know what I'm talking about. Love is not on the make. But love is free to lose itself in the person at hand. Love seeketh not its own. Love is not irritable, is not easily provoked. I'm going to skip over that. That's a problem I have. That's not even... It's one of these new... You know, Paige is always telling me this NIV is tricky, and that's probably a... I think of two dogs in my neighborhood when I was growing up. One was a Pomeranian, just a nervous little nasty dog, just kind of walked around on its toenails like this, and just always ready to snap at you. And I forget the name of the dog, but we just didn't want to be around that dog, just ready to snap at you. Then there was a what's the one with a keg around its neck? St. Bernard. This one didn't have a keg, but this St. Bernard was up the hill, belonged to another faculty member, and the dog was named Heidi. Heidi had these big old roomy eyes, just that kind of tears draining down, big old floppy ears, and there was a little kid that belonged to the dog, or the dog belonged to the kid. The kid was named Megan, and I remember Megan would just swing on Heidi's ears, and that poor dog just sit there with those sad eyes, just how long, Lord, you know? And there may have been some time when that dog finally snapped, but I never saw it. And I think that the Bible does teach us here that we are to be more like the St. Bernard than the Pomeranian, and that we are to let people swing on our ears and grab us by the cheek and hang on the back and then not snap at them. And that's the way of love. Love is not irritable. Love is not mindful of debts, doesn't keep a careful record of debts. That's easy to do. I just heard recently the old illustration of the marriage counselor who talked about the wife or the husband who got historical instead of hysterical, brings up everything done wrong in the past. Remember when Lady Di and Prince Charles got married? I don't know if you remember this, but it was, I don't know, early in the morning. It was 2 in the morning, Chicago time when I lived there, and I saw the reruns. And one thing that struck me about this wedding ceremony was that when Lady Di was at the platform being married, I think her train was still in the carriage. You know, it was the longest train, the most amazing thing, and I don't know how she walked down the aisle with it. And I think we have a tendency when we deal with one another to say, wait, before you talk here, let me just open the chest here and get out the train of the remembrance of all the disappointments I have in you and your life, and let me just spread this thing out and attach it to you, and now I can deal with you while I have that train in my mind, because I like to remember all those things. And that really is not the way of love, to be mindful of debts and a train of disappointments. Love does not rejoice in wrong. It is not tickled at moral failure. Comedians are. You know, when a televangelist falls or something like this happens, then Leno and Letterman and those guys have material for weeks. It gives them something to do with their lives. It's even a profitable sort of thing. They have a party over someone's difficulties. It's juicy. It's wonderful stuff. But that's not the way of love. Love is not tickled at moral failure. Love is not temporary. Love never fails. When I came out of college in the 70s, they were changing the wedding vows a little bit back then. You know, the classic one is this, till death do us part. And they said things like, as long as love shall last. And it helped. It helped if you were like in a Nehru jacket, and she had flowers in her hair, and they were on a cliff somewhere near Big Sur, and a Native American was performing the ceremony, and then you say, "As long as love shall last." Well, folks, if it's love, it lasts, because love never fails, and the world will not teach you that, but the Bible will teach you that. Well, love is some things. Love is not just not things. Love is things. Love is patient. I think the Greek word makrothumia, it means long-tempered as opposed to short-tempered. Love is patient. I worked at a scout camp one summer, and one of the guys was a college student, and he had a boat. And one day he said, "Have you ever slalomed?" And I'd skied on 2 skis before at different things. I said, "No." He said, "Come on, I'll teach you to slalom this afternoon." Wrong. We got out on Lake Greeson there in Arkansas, and just this guy and this little scout leader, and so he showed me how to put my feet in the skis, and we took off, and he was trolling with me is what he was doing, and I was drinking the lake, and finally I let go of the ski rope in exhaustion, and I thought he was going to spin around and say, "Well, this isn't working, let's head on back to the camp." He said, "Oh, no, what you do now is you put more weight, you lean more on the front foot and push down." "Okay, thanks." Trolling and trolling, finally let go in exhaustion, drinking the other half of the lake. Comes around, he says, "I tell you what, why don't you lean back, you know?" And we tried that. I mean, it went 9, 10, 11 times. And every time he came around, I thought he would dismiss me. And he just, "No, you know, you're doing great. No, this is really hard, you know, and you've got all the natural capacities, and we're just this close." And finally we gave up. I later did slalom, by the way, the end of the story, but not that day. But I'll never forget the cheerfulness and the patience of this man, and it strikes me as a model of love, because love is patient. Love is kind. Kindness is rarer than you might suppose, even in Christendom. When I came out of Vanderbilt, freshly minted with a PhD, I thought that they would have to take numbers to get to me. The schools would have to do the Baskin-Robbins thing and say, compete to get me, and I was wrong there as well. There were no jobs in philosophy. I wrote 20 Baptist schools. My daddy taught at Ouachita, and he had taught at Carson Newman and Belmont, and so I was steeped in Southern Baptist college life, and so I wrote 20 schools. It turns out none of them, no school had a job at all. There were no openings in philosophy. 10 of them didn't write back at all, just never heard from them. And you know, when you've applied for a job or something like that, the mailbox becomes the spiritual center of the universe, you know? The mailman becomes, you know, the man in your life. And And so I would wait, and 10 never wrote back. I think it was 5 wrote a form letter. Dear occupant, you know, you have good credentials. God bless you. I know he'll use you in great ways. We have no openings, you know, that sort of thing. And okay. And 5 of them took the time to write a personal note. Just something like, boy, I enjoyed reading this, and I particularly appreciate this. We don't have something right now, but we'll keep it on file, and, you know, this kind of thing. Every one of them had to say no. There was no budget. There was no opening. But 5 said it with peculiar kindness. And that was the way of love. The way of love was not to say, yes, here's a job, because there was no job. The way of love was to say no with a particular kind of grace. And I will never forget those letters. I keep them to this day. This is science fiction. Love rejoices in truth. Love is glad when truth is found, when someone is right. Now, just let's imagine this. This will be science fiction, but let's imagine that you're in a Sunday school class and you're arguing over what something means, a verse means, and then it's not resolved, and you go home and study, and then you find out that he was right and you were wrong. And then you come and thank him for straightening you out, and you say it in front of the class, and admit that you were wrong, and you're just having a party over how you learned something that you didn't know. Now, I know you may see this a decade from now, sometime or other. That's not what happens. When we are corrected and we learn something, anybody reasonable, you know, we huff around, and we don't have a party when we learn that we were wrong, because we're so full of ourselves that we are defensive or we are embarrassed, and we can't have a party over truth at our expense. But the way of love is free to have a party over truth found, because it is forgetful of self. Love protects. Love is protective. Do you remember the story of Noah, after the ark and the success and the animals and so forth? Then there's a sad part where Noah gets drunk and naked in his tent. Do you remember that? It's not one of those Bible memory verses in Bible school, but it's in there, you know? And Noah's messed up in his tent there. And the first one to go in is Ham. You remember? And Ham goes in and he says, whoa, look at Daddy. He's messed up. This is really exciting stuff. You know, this is the event in the camp today. And Ham runs out and gets Shem and Japheth to say, come look, Daddy's messed up. Do you remember what Shem and Japheth do? Shem and Japheth refuse to look at Dad. They take a garment and they back into the tent and lay the garment on him. They refuse to get in on the party of someone's debacle. Our impulse is Ham's impulse. Hey, this is really cool. This is exciting. Let's chat it up. Let's take photos. But the way of love protects and covers someone's nakedness and shame. Love trusts. If the Church of God could just get to the level of the secular courts, we'd have revival. Innocent until proven guilty. Love hopes. Love hopes. It's tough to do sometimes. I remember when I was a pastor, I was on the softball team, and, here comes the pastor. Let's see, where can he do the least damage? Right field, maybe. Catch, you know, just kind of a blunt instrument back there to stop the ball. Something like that. And so in the course of the game, I had popped out or grounded out or something a couple of times, and it's right at the end, and we're tied, and I'm on deck, and as I start to go up there, Lee Miller, our coach of Miller Trucking Company, yelled to my back, get a hit. There's no evidence on earth that I would get a hit. There's no evidence that that was a likelihood, and I thought that he was being sarcastic, and I could see him turning to the dugout in my mind's eye, and snickering and winking, you know, get a hit. But I screwed up my courage and turned around and looked him in the face, and there was the most innocent, believing, enthusiastic face. Get a hit. He thinks I could get a hit. He loves me. And my wife, every day, in a sense, you know, despite all the evidence to the contrary, get a hit. That's the way of love. Love hopes. Love is durable. Love perseveres. Boy, that is that's tough. I remember marriage counseling, the pastor is sort of like, they come in like one nanosecond before murder or divorce, and they want you to bless it. You know, that sort of thing, what they're going to do. But, you know, she'll come in and say, listen, I slave away, and he goes off to work, and I keep the kids and don't have an intelligent conversation all day long, and then he comes home, and I just want 15 minutes of talk with an adult. He plops down in his easy chair there, watches ESPN, drinks a beer, goes out and plays softball at night, and finally he'll take me out to the mall, get me some Chick-fil-A, and take me to a movie and say, there, are you happy? I want to get a gun. I want to go find this guy. Then he comes in, and he says, you know what, I slave at that tire plant all day, and I got carbon all over me, and people screaming at me, and my hands are burned and blistered, and the sound of the machines are going all day, and I just want to have 15 minutes of peace when I get home. And she's just nipping at me about taking the garbage out, and she won't fix my socks, and she's always nagging, and stuff. And I want to go out and get a gun and go after her. And they think they've played their trump card. You know, well, he treats me this way. Well, oh, hey, that's it, man. It's all over. And same with... And it's always kind of surprising. I don't put it quite this way, but it's like, hello, Berlin. Listen, welcome to marriage. Two flawed people trapped in a small space for years. You know, it's you know, it's unthinkable. You're catching on. Now we know where to start. Because love perseveres. Love hangs in there. Love is indispensable. Though I do A, B, C, D, and E and have not love, it's nothing, nada. Now, I tell you, one of the most inspirational things I ever did was when I was the faculty advisor to the BSU at Wheaton. And we had this Chicago-wide BSU hunger relief emphasis, and we were going to auction ourselves off as slaves to raise money for hunger relief in Somalia or someplace like this. And so I put the pitch out, and our little BSU auctioned itself at our church there in Glen Ellyn, Illinois. Well, we had one family in the church who hired us for $100 to scrape the eaves and paint the eaves in their house. I was a first-year teacher or second-year teacher, had a lot of preparations, just strained. I needed those Saturdays. Somehow or other, when we came to the time to scrape the eaves, the students found other things to do. Just, wouldn't you know it, just high-level things, and they were busy, and maybe one showed up. And it turns out the eaves were, I think, were 32 feet in the air, and I got one of these extending ladders, and I'm up there scraping, and it turned out, I think it was a $1,000 job at least. We're doing for $100 for these cheapskates, and I'm scraping up there, and I'm kind of wobbling on this thing, and I'm thinking, I'm going to do a gainer off of this thing. I'm going to be a quadriplegic. I resent how little they're paying us. No one's here. I don't have the time to do this. I don't care if Africa drops into the ocean here. You know, I just am doing this grimly. But if you took the picture, if a film crew from NAM came, it would have been inspirational. Young faculty member serving the Lord, you know, scraping for world hunger and stuff. I want to tell you, my soul was a cinder. And God was scoring this noble effort that took a couple of Saturdays up there risking quadriplegia. And he scored it, and you know what I got for all that? Nothing. Because there was no love in it. And love is supreme. The greatest of these. We've got a song about that, isn't it? Love is the theme, love is supreme. We do have one. Love is not envious, not boastful, proud, rude, self-seeking, irritable, mindful of debts, tickled at moral... do 80% of the serving. Let us resolve that we be in the 20% that does 80% of the loving. For the glory of God, by His power, filled with His Spirit, straining for the standard. Grant it, Lord.
Thank you so much, Dr. Coppinger, and I'm not sure I can live up to all of that, but you've certainly placed the standard high, and I trust that we shall all point ourselves in that direction for this entire school year. May that chapter characterize how we live and what we do. Now, Let me remind you that tomorrow in chapel, the new pastor of the First Baptist Church in Dallas, Texas, Dr. Mac Brunson, will be with us in chapel, and so we'll see you then. And now we're going to introduce you to the seminary hymn. Those of you who are new will not have a clue about what you're doing for the next few minutes, but then we'll learn it as we go along. And so Professor Nelson's going to come and lead us as we sing the first three stanzas of the seminary hymn. We'll ask you to remain standing for the benediction led by Dr. Steve McKinnon, and then just stay right where you are, if you will, while our faculty recesses, and we'll see you in class. Thank you, Dr. Coppinger, for coming to speak to us today. Would you stand with us, please?
God and Father, as we reflect on the challenge that we have just received, we are reminded of our woeful inadequacy and our inability to live up to the standard. Yet at the same time, we're reminded that by your grace, the righteousness of Christ is ours, and we depend wholly and solely on that grace and are grateful for it. As we leave now to commence this semester, I pray for our president, the vice presidents, and the rest of the administration. Grant to them, by your grace, the wisdom of all eternity. I pray as well for our faculty. Grant to us the ability to exemplify to our students a character of sobriety and self-mastery in all things, a dependence on you for everything in our lives. Help us to take seriously our responsibility that it is to guide and to prepare them for their present and future ministries. I pray for our students. Pray that you would grant to them the academic, the financial, the emotional, and the spiritual needs that they have for the semester. I pray you would help them to see the seriousness of their responsibilities over this semester, that they would take very seriously.